Now, for example, the attitude of the communists at the time of the Stalin-Hitler Pact was that the war was an imperialist war, and it was business as usual as far as fighting for the rights of the workers. But as soon as Germany invaded Russia, the tactic turned around completely, and people were urged to continue with war production regardless of their working conditions. This is not an exaggeration. I remember the strike of the street railwaymen in Vancouver during that period. It must have been the mid-40s. And while the CCF people were supporting the street railwaymen in their strike, the communist union people were telling people to get to work any way they could.
In other words, to scab on a strike?
Well, get pool transportation, etc., etc. Let me turn it off a minute. The function of the CCF Trade Union Committee was to coordinate the activity of our members in locals all across the province. And we were able to make contact with them, not by doing a lot of traveling, but when they came to Vancouver for conventions or anything of that kind, my job was to arrange informal meetings of our CCF group, discuss how they were doing in the various industries in which they were represented. Early on, of course, there was an attempt to challenge the leadership in the Vancouver Labor Council, which was dominated by the Communist Party, as was the BC Federation in those days. And I was a delegate to the council and instrumental in holding caucus meetings of delegates before every labor council meeting. We used to meet in the steelworkers' office and discuss what resolutions we thought we would bring up, or what criticism we would make of the policies being followed by the council. I remember a number of people who used to attend those caucuses very faithfully. George Holm, for example, who was initially with the Boilermakers and then brought his local into the Steelworkers Union, later became a president of the BC Federation, and following that, political education director for the Canadian Labor Congress. Jim Bury, another one, became an organizer for the packing house workers, editor of their paper, education director, and today is a labor counselor for the Canadian government in London, England. Another very colorful personality was Malcolm Bruce, who at one time had been in the Communist Party and was associated with the Amalgamated Building Workers, a small group who never did succeed in ousting the craft unions from the building trades. Malcolm was very effective in the Vancouver Labor Council meetings, except that he was by this time quite an age, and he used to go home before midnight, so that was when all the action took place. They figured
so
if they could
leave
No, that they always figured that whoever they could tear you out to staying till midnight, they could have a majority to carry out what they wanted. I'm talking about the leader. Well, we did build up opposition until the year that I left, 1947. We came within one vote of taking over the offices of the Vancouver Labour Council. And the next year, of course, the communists were ousted from the IWA and then subsequently from the Labour Council also.
Okay, to go back a little bit, what were some of the differences that you perceived between the BC Labour Movement and the Ontario Labour Movement when you came out here?
There was a much higher degree of politicization. Is that the right word? Politicization. It's a clumsy word. Let's forget it. They were much more politicized because the
In BC.
Yeah. The socialist movement had been more developed, had more various shades of opinion than in any other part of Canada. And they'd also had a longer history of unionism, radical unionism, in the basic industries. They had the IWW in the logging and mining camps in the early days. You had, I believe, some influence from the One Big Union movement, which started in Winnipeg. So there was quite a difference politically in the development of an interest in politics in the trade union movement in BC amongst the leadership. I don't think amongst the rank and file there was any difference.
Right. So that also probably meant that the political differences amongst that leadership would be more intense.
Exactly, yeah.
And did that also mean that the CCF was able to play more of a role in BC within the union movement than in Ontario, or was it pretty well?
I wouldn't say that the CCF as a party played a big role in either Ontario or BC. Now, to explain myself, the people within the CCF who were active trade unionists played a role which was following more closely the CCF policy. And I suppose the fundamental difference between the two is that while the communists believe that the end justifies the means, we've always taken the stand that the means will determine the end. And therefore, if you one minute are telling the workers they should vote for the Liberals, and then the next minute telling them vote for the CCF, you're just contributing to the general confusion. And nobody ever learns that a basic change in the society, in the economic system, is necessary.
Did that difference in ways of working manifest itself in other ways? For example, the LPP wanted unions to affiliate to them. Did they want affiliation, or did they want to win the leadership as LPP people?
I can't recall that they proposed affiliation at all. They worked in different ways. Just prior to the 30s, the Workers' Unity League was fairly active, and this was almost an adjunct of the Communist Party, but not entirely. So it wasn't a question of affiliation, but of an organization which they dominated.
Okay, and that was quite distinct from how the CCM saw in its way of operating?
Well, particularly in the Canadian Congress of Labor, not in the GLC, but in the CCL, most of the leaders, including A.R. Mosher, who was the head of it, certainly C.H. Millard, who was the most influential CCFer in the labor movement, were able to convince conventions to endorse the CCF as the political arm of labor. Later on, they formed political action committees to carry this out within the labor movement. And there are a number of good texts which deal with this phase. This is one of them.
A related question would be then, what was the CCF attitude towards the war, and how did that affect the kinds of positions that you would take in unions, as opposed to those of the Labour Progressive Party, which argued for war production, overtime, and so on?
The CCF, I think, had a number of attitudes towards the war, ranging from coolness to later to full cooperation. Their stand was for conscription of wealth at the same time as men were conscripted. And of course this never came about. So that at first they were opposed to conscripting men unless wealth was conscripted. I don't think that, if my recollection is right, during the war that the needs of the workers were ever subordinated, shall we say, to the needs of the war. We felt that if people didn't get organized when they had some security, and don't forget they'd just come out of a long depression, that they never would. And it wasn't that they made such tremendous economic gains. The average increase, I think, would be about 5 cents an hour. But it was to get their organization established.
Recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So that would include a different attitude towards, for example, signing a no-strike pledge?
Yes.
Now, another question then would be, if both the CCF or CCF members and LPP members were instrumental in organizing in industries where there were women present, what kind of attitudes did both organizations, this is tricky, but I think it's somewhat relevant, positions on women have in terms of how they would argue for women to be organized, or what kind of contract positions they would suggest for women, for example, equal pay and equal work? Was there a program on women?
I don't think there was a difference really between the two on that sort of basis at all. And now remember that I wasn't organizing in VC, so I can't speak from personal experience here. But I don't think there has ever been a difference between the two political groups as far as economic standards of women are concerned.
So now can we go on to some of the union activity that you were involved in while you were out here? You were involved in organizing, negotiating an office contract. Can you describe that?
I haven't kept a copy of that contract. I don't imagine that it would be very outstanding compared with conditions today, but it was the first agreement for a white collar union in the CCL, and it was between the Office and Professional Workers Organizing Committee and the co-op. I can't just recall whether it was the central office of the co-op. Green Melvin was the head of it at the time, negotiated with him, or whether it was a credit union. But it was the first agreement of its kind and provided some basis for other white-collar people to see what could be gained by organization. One of the major reasons for organizing after wages, which are or salaries, which are usually central, has always been the security of employment. And this is equally important to white-collar or industrial workers. The provision of grievance procedure so that people can't be arbitrarily fired, and seniority provisions so that length of service will determine in layoffs to a good degree who stays and who goes. So these, I'm quite sure that this first contract we're speaking about did include protection in both of those regards.
How did the workers become interested in unionization?
Well, I suppose they saw the results of organization all around them, particularly being a co-op organization, the customers and the contacts would largely be union people. And that probably was their motivation.
Was there any attempt to use that contract as the basis to go out to other office workers at all?
Not at that time that I recall. Well, there were always attempts to interest office workers, but they were very slow in getting interested. And I don't know of any plants in the steelworkers which organized their office workers at that time. Although later on, of course, both American Can, Continental Can, had master agreements covering plant and office.
Right, and you were involved in the struggle of American Can.
Yes.
Can you describe that?
Well, it was a rather interesting strike because it was the first strike in Canada, I believe, on the issue of union security. And what they wanted was a union shop. In other words, that when a person was hired, they were required to join the union. This was Local 2821 of the United Steelworkers.
So it was precedent setting.
It was. It was also fought very bitterly by the company for the same reason, that the employers could see that if we won a strike for union shop in one place, it would spread to the rest. And so the company held out and held out. If you want to cut the machine off. The settlement of that strike, which was reached on September 20th, 1945, followed a mediation by Justice Richards. And while the union shop, pure and simple, was not won, the settlement contained some very innovative provisions for union security. It combined a maintenance of membership clause that once a person joined, they must maintain their membership for the life of the agreement, an irrevocable checkoff In other words, once they had signed the check off, then the dues were deducted for the rest of the life of the agreement. And a provision that isn't found in too many agreements, that the company would give every new employee a card stating that Local 2821 was the exclusive bargaining agency, and that the company, while not requiring the person to join the union, approves of membership in the union, that a copy of the agreement and the membership application forms can be obtained from the department steward and giving the employee the steward's name. For 1945, this was a pretty unique settlement. I recall the settlement quite well. I took an active part in the strike on the picket line and in discussing the terms of settlement with the union, local union leaders. I remember that at one point, because of the concern over the fact that here was a plant out on strike during the war, that a vice president of the Canadian Congress of Labor addressed a meeting of the strikers, urging them to settle and not stick by their union shop demands. I spoke, I believe, following him at the meeting, and as did others, and as a result, the vote was to stay on strike till they got closer to their demands.
Great.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I have a card still as a volunteer picketer in that strike. I used to get up and spend some time with them on the picket line before in the morning before I went to the office.
Was that both men and women on strike? Was it mostly men?
And there were men and women.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mostly men, but there were women workers.
Did you notice, and were those women plant workers, production mm-hmm. workers? Did you notice a difference in any of the attitudes between the men and the women and their degree of involvement in the union?
Well, the men were certainly much more involved. I think all the officers of the plant were men.
The union were men.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was because the women saw themselves as only temporary workers for the war period?
Well, not entirely, but where there are predominantly men in a plant, I think it's only natural that the leadership is dominated by men. And women are not usually prepared to give the time, and usually they can't give it because of their home commitments that men can give to doing work for the union.
Right. Were there any special provisions in the contracts that dealt with women, for example, equal pay and equal work clauses or maternity benefits?
No. In fact, I'm a little bit wondering now whether there actually were women in the American can at that time. There certainly were in the can plants later. I'm not sure that, I think maybe that's not accurate that there were women there. I don't remember them.
Yeah.
And I would remember, I think, if there were any.
Right.
Yeah.
You were also a delegate to the Labor Council in this period of time you were talking.
Yes,
right.
Throughout that period.
Can you mm-hmm. talk about, you talked about being involved in helping to lead the caucus at that time
yeah.
within the Labor Council. What other kinds of things did you do on the Labor Council? What kind of positions would you argue for?
Well, what kind of positions did I hold?
Well,
no?
Yeah, you were a delegate, and
that
were
was
you a
all.
Delegate for steel?
Yes,
yeah,
for my local union.
So, right, and Would you speak generally around issues that affected the union as a whole? And you were you in the leadership of the caucus that was built?
Yes.
Right.
And I was the only woman in it.
Were you the only woman on the Labor Council as well?
No, but we're very, very few.
Right. What other unions did the women come from?
One other activity which brought me into contact with a lot of trade union people in the AFL section was when the United Mine Workers sent out two men from Cape Breton during their strike in the early 40s, and I was asked by the, I think by the Labor Council, to arrange an itinerary so that they could make the appeal for strike assistance to the affiliates of the Trades and Labor Congress. And I did take them with me to a meeting of the Vancouver TLC and around and arranged for them to get around the province generally. It was a very enjoyable 2 weeks. I got to know conditions that miners worked under. Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. The mine workers always had a strong women's auxiliary, I understand too, in part because being in company towns with...
Yes.
Yeah. Did you run into the women's auxiliaries at all when you were traveling around?
No.
Okay. I don't know how active they were in that period of time. Okay. And on the Labor Council, were there... this was a period, 1945, from some of the things I've read, women were organizing, domestic workers were organizing as well. Now, I think that was within the TLC.
It must have been. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also hotel and restaurant workers.
Yes, that would be TLC also.
Right. There were separate labor councils.
Oh, yes. The Canadian Congress of Labor and the Trades and Labor Congress of Canada both had separate councils across in all the provinces and separate centers in Canada. Separate conventions. However, I recall that we had good relations with a number of the AFL union just the same. The Seafarers Union was quite active in assisting us in the American Can strike, and I used to get up and help George Johnson hand out leaflets at the Hudson Bay Company, which was, I guess, the first attempt to try and get that store organized. The meat cutters had the meat department in Woodward's and never could get beyond that. And to this day, of course, none of the department stores in Vancouver and environs are organized.
Other than leafleting, were you involved? Did you do more work around the Bay organizing drive?
No.
How successful were they with that drive? Did you know anything about it? They failed, obviously.
They failed, yes. I don't think they attracted enough interest amongst the employees.
Right.